At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
All right, welcome back here to Mornings on the Mall. The Vice President of the United States literally making his way over right now as we speak. Hello, Mr. Vice President. Nice to speak to you. Look, he's sitting down here, joining us here on Mornings on the Mall. Really appreciate that. Mike Pence is here. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Thanks for making the long drive to come to the White House.
Really appreciate it.
It was far, but we did it.
Coming in from the mall.
Exactly. Well,
let us start with some news. The President of the United States just tweeting a few minutes ago here.
Right.
Representative Tom Marino has informed me that he is withdrawing his name from consideration as drug czar. Tom is a fine man and a great congressman. What's your reaction to Marino pulling his name? And can the media claim a scalp here?
Well, we think very highly of Congressman Marino and respect his decision to withdraw. What I can tell you, and it'll be evident next week when the president makes a very significant announcement in this space, is that President Trump is absolutely determined to confront the issue of opiate addiction across this country. I can tell you, when I was governor of the state of Indiana, we saw the way that opiate addiction was tearing apart families. When I was governor, we broke ground on the first mental health hospital that had been built in a generation in the state of Indiana, trying to expand capacity for people to have treatment. But President Trump assembled a task force with a broad range of recommendations, and we're completely focused on making sure that we have the policies and the personnel, and we take the executive action to bring real relief to families that are struggling under the horrible, horrible weight of addiction and loss.
I'd like to also talk about tax relief. A lot of people are very excited about the prospect of tax cuts and revamping the tax system. People have been asking for it for a really long time. How long is it going to take for them to see relief? What's the timeline here?
Well, we're working on it very earnestly. The process is we first pass a budget that's passed the House. This week the Senate will vote on a budget, and then that will create, as you all understand, a legislative process will allow us to bring a tax cut even before the end of this year to the floor of the Congress. And we're working very earnestly to do that. President Trump and I believe passionately that the time has come for the kind of tax cuts that will unleash the full potential of the American economy. The good news is the economy is growing. We've seen 1.2 million new jobs created. We've been rolling back red tape at a historic pace. Business optimism is at, in many cases, a 20-year high. But we think by allowing Americans to keep more of what they earn, making the first $24,000 in every American's income completely tax-free for working families, lowering the business tax rate so that American companies can be competitive on the world stage again, is all going to set it's going to set the table for a tremendous economic growth, jobs, and opportunity in the future.
Let me ask you about the middle class. I know that the focus that the president has, and he said it yesterday as well, is to bring relief to the middle class. We've seen some estimates that 25% of the middle class could see something of a tax hike if the numbers settle out in the same spots. For like the 25% tax bracket, for instance, they lose deductions, they stay in a 25% tax bracket, they'll pay more. Should or will anybody in the middle class pay more under the Trump tax plan?
I think the president's made it very clear the priority here is tax cuts for the middle class, is to make sure that working families experience the kind of savings in their taxes that, as the president said, could average in some cases upwards of $4,000 a year. And I have to tell you, as I've traveled around the country, the enthusiasm for that focus, I think, is very, very welcome. Look, we want to have across-the-board tax relief, and we want to simplify and lower tax rates. But by eliminating many of the loopholes that have benefited the wealthy over the years, we think that the real focus of this will be on middle-class Americans. And that, combined with the business tax cuts that we're going to include in this bill, we think are going to create real economic growth and prosperity. You know, the best thing we can do for the American middle class is get this economy rolling again and get it out of the ditch that we've been in at under 2% growth now for the last 8 years. We've already done that, but we want sustained positive growth over 3%. And the best thing we can do is let people have more money in their pockets and then watch this economy grow and create jobs.
Now, to that point, people listening right now are like, great, middle class hats. Everybody thinks they're middle class. So how do you define middle class? How does the administration define middle class? What income do I need to be middle class?
Well, I'm in it. I'm in it. You know, I mean, I shop at Joseph A. Banks. You know.
Oh, yeah, they got some good deals. They got that 3-for-1 going on.
Yeah, you know, I got student loans, you know, for my kids. I mean, look, this is, you know, I think we all know that it's vitally important that we have a tax code that takes into account people that are just getting started on the American dream. And I think by making sure that the first $24,000 in income is completely tax-free for working families, the president's putting a real focus on lower-income Americans. By eliminating loopholes, even while we lower the top marginal rate, the president's making it clear that the purpose of this tax cut is really to focus on Americans that are out there paying our bills, supporting our families, putting our kids through college, and that's where the focus will remain.
Are there some people, though, who think they're going to get a tax cut because they think they're middle class, are going to suddenly find out that they're wealthy?
No, I think there's. I really think there's going to be broad-based tax relief here.
Okay.
And we're engaging members of Congress on the details of that. I think before it's said and done, this is going to be the most significant tax cut in more than 30 years, may well be the largest tax cut in American history. And that, combined with what we're doing and making the right kind of investments in our national defense, making the right kind of investments next year, as the president's talked about, in an infrastructure bill, rolling back red tape, we think is a prescription for really boundless American growth.
In the little time we have left, can you tell us about what's your relationship with Congress, specifically the Senate right now, as you try and twist some arms to get people to support this? And does Mitch McConnell's future ride on whether or not this actually gets through?
Well, you know, I served in the House of Representatives before I was a governor, and had the privilege of serving as president of the Senate under the Constitution. I spent a fair amount of time, as you all know, on Capitol Hill. And as the president said yesterday, our administration enjoys strong relationships with members of the Republican majority in the Senate. We've had our differences with a few. We've been disappointed once or twice. But 182 nominations that have been confirmed, rolling back red tape the way we've been able to do it, Justice Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. The Senate has been producing for the American people and delivering, and we're very confident as we move into this debate over tax reform, as we take on other issues, that we're going to continue to see the kind of support and cooperation from not only Republicans, but I think, stay tuned, we think there's going to be more than a few Democrats in the Senate and the House that join us on tax reform before it's all done.
Manchin, McCaskill, anybody?
Stay tuned. You know, the president's been reaching out. I've been reaching out in a bipartisan way. Look, throughout our history, President Kennedy, President Reagan, it was bipartisan support for real tax cuts for the American people. We're going to work our hearts out
all
to
right.
make this a bipartisan tax
we're
cut as
hold
well.
Hold you to that.
Well, that was the Vice President of the United States. Thank you very much
for
joining
you
us
so
this morning.
Much.
Great to see
we're
you.
So honored to have you.
And you're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Uranium is a big subject. If the mainstream media would cover the uranium scandal and that Russia has 20% of her uranium, for whatever reason, and a lot of people understand what those reasons may be, I think that's your Russia story. That's your real Russia story. Not a story where they talk about collusion and there was none. It was a hoax.
All right, and here to talk to us about that real Russia story is Victoria Tensing. She's a former Reagan Justice Department official, former chief counsel of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Victoria, good morning and welcome to Mornings on the Mall. How are you?
Good morning, Mary. So nice to talk to you now that we've met.
Yes, it was very nice meeting you. You have a very interesting story here. You have a client who is an American businessman. He claims to have worked for years as an undercover FBI confidential witness regarding this entire Russia uranium scandal, really, where Russians were, where there was money laundering involved and kickbacks and all sorts of things. He was prevented by the Obama administration, he alleges, from telling his story. And forced to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Mary, when he started working for the FBI, working undercover in 2009, they had him sign a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, as we call it. He went into the FBI to talk to them about being asked to give out bribes and work with kickbacks in the Russian nuclear energy factor. He was working for them. He was under contract.
So what brought him to the FBI? Just a crisis of conscience? He was like, man, they're asking me for bribes. I better tell the FBI.
This isn't right. And he had a relationship with an FBI agent earlier on a matter. And so he contacted that agent, and then he began working undercover, because the FBI looks at this and says, my gosh, this is not only corruption with the bribery and kickbacks, but nuclear energy, Russia, we could learn a lot. You know, so it started out as really kind of a counterintelligence matter. But imagine my client's surprise when he's been working in this for well over a year. In October of 2010, when the U.S. government gives its blessing to the same corrupt Russian entities being able to buy an American uranium asset. It was a Canadian company. I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but it included 20% of America's uranium supply.
Directly connected to the company that this guy was working for.
Yeah, and he's saying, "Why? I mean, why are they being allowed to do this?"
So tell me, I'm curious, Victoria. As this story's been developing, obviously a lot of attention is being paid to it. How does it work? Just at the process of you, first of all, representing this client, and also like, how do you establish when somebody approaches you like this? This is a huge story, one that you're going to be representing in him public for. How do you establish his credibility and determine, yeah, this guy was genuinely an FBI informant and he genuinely was forced to sign an NDA by the government?
It's called documents. Now, I looked at all the documents that he had, but the NDA, I don't have the NDA, and neither does he. In 2016, he brought a civil lawsuit because he had not been paid, was his understanding, with the FBI. And when he brought that suit, the Loretta Lynch Justice Department called his then lawyer and said he signed an NDA, and if he continues, if he doesn't voluntarily withdraw the suit, talking about all of this stuff, his reputation and liberty are being threatened. Liberty? I've never heard of a threat of prosecution for violating an NDA. So when Congress wanted to talk to him about this, he said, I can't because I've been threatened by the Justice Department. So where we are now is we want to get this Justice Department to release him. And I find that clip from the president interesting, because all he has to do is pick up the phone and call Jeff Sessions and say, release him.
Yeah. Are you under the impression that Jeff Sessions may consider himself recused from this matter because he had issued that blanket recusal in the 2016 election, and that apparently includes anything that involves Russia?
No. That's not an accurate description of Jeff's recusal. He had to recuse himself from the campaign, but that does not extend to all things Russian.
Right.
In fact, it was Rod Rosenstein who was in charge of this case when he was U.S. Attorney in Baltimore.
Wow, so this is really, really muddy. And we have Charles Grassley, the Senate Judiciary Chair, who asked you if you can get this guy to testify. But as you said, he's got an NDA. You've got to clear that up. So maybe the pressure coming from Chuck Grassley will help push this.
That's why I went to Chuck Grassley. I figured Chuck Grassley asking for this was better than my knocking on the doors at the FBI and asking them to release it. But here, it's a constitutional issue. The executive branch cannot prevent people from talking to the legislative branch. That's separation of power. So what Chuck Grassley has done is really set at issue the separation of powers issue. I don't see how Sessions can turn it down.
Yeah, one would think, although Congress has had a hard time getting even the Trump dossier information out of the FBI as they have been seeking answers from them.
Yes, as my husband Joe says every Monday, the Republicans are lousy at oversight. But look at Grassley's been really good on this one.
I wonder, this is, obviously the FBI has changed hands, the Justice Department has changed hands, but now we know details of your client's work, thanks in part to you getting them out there, and then some of this reporting from The Hill and Circa this week. Is there any concern now? Have you heard at all from the Justice Department or the FBI about the status of that NDA in light of the fact that some of your client's details are now out in public?
Well, I'm not giving any details about the investigation at all because I can't violate the NDA either. All I'm talking about is process. I'm talking about, things that occurred in a procedural way, but not the substance of his investigation.
But revealing the fact that he was an FBI informant and that there was an FBI informant in this type of investigation, that does not violate the NDA?
No, that doesn't.
Okay.
That won't. But, isn't it kind of strange that the person in charge of that investigation when my client was working is Bob Mueller? Bob Mueller, the one who is now in charge of looking for Russian collusion among the Trump people.
So given all of this, it's like a bowl of spaghetti with all these intertwined pieces, right? Most scandal stories are like that. Given all of that, what do you think the odds are of your client being able to get out and truly tell publicly what he knows?
Well, Mary, as I said, I think they're very good. By the way, as I also said, all the president has to do is call the Justice Department and say, please release him from his NDA. He's the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. But I don't see how this situation can hold up. Jeff Sessions is going to have to make a decision, and it's going to have to be that my client can give information to the Senate.
Wow. Okay. Thank you, Victoria Tunsing. Nice to talk to you
this
morning.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. Of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Mary Walter with Vince Colonnese, and we are broadcasting this morning live from the White House, getting you the scoop, trying to get some answers on the president's tax plan, because everybody wants to know how is it going to affect me. To answer some of those questions right now, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for being here at the White House with us today.
Really nice to have you. I want to ask you about the big news yesterday. Mitch McConnell shows up at the White House. They have that lunch, come out and do the press briefing. And tax reform play is obviously at the center of much of this. And I wonder, the president seems to be under a bunch of pressure from people on the outside. Steve Bannon, Ken Cuccinelli, other conservatives to not have confidence in Mitch McConnell. Yet he comes out, voices support for him yesterday. Is this moment, this tax reform plan, is this the thing on which his confidence in Mitch McConnell hinges?
Look, I think his confidence hinges in their relationship. They have a great relationship. They speak regularly. But I think the biggest thing here is you talk about outside pressure. I think the pressure really is on from the American people for all of these individuals to come together for some reason or another. Everyone elected them to come here to do something, to work together, and to get things done, and tax reform being at the top of the list for demands that we've heard that people want. They want to see some change, and you've got two people committed, willing, and wanting to make sure that happens.
How important, I know the president golfed with Rand Paul this weekend, how important was that exchange in getting Rand Paul over to his side on tax reform, and how close does the White House feel like you guys are to getting those 50 votes for this budget resolution?
Look, we're confident we're going to push through on the budget. I believe that's tomorrow. My days are kind of running together. Sometimes it's hard to remember if it's Monday or Friday. But I think we feel very good about that. We know that that's an important step in the tax process. And look, this is a president who's very hands-on. He's going directly to members and making the case on why we need to get this done, how it's going to impact people in their state in a positive way. And I think that he and Senator Paul, while they disagree on a lot of things, they have a very good relationship. I think they have the ability to be very candid with one another. And I think we're going to get there on the budget and then certainly get there on tax reform.
Behind the scenes, how hands-on is the president in crafting the details of this bill?
The president's very engaged. This is something that is, you know, at the heart of who he is. He's a businessman. He's somebody who, you know, has spent a lifetime focusing on kind of the ups and downs of a market, how different tax rates may impact both his companies, the people that work at his companies. He's somebody who has a better understanding, I think, given his background on how a tax reform and tax cuts can really impact every American. I think you see that reflected in the broadness of this framework.
We wanted to talk to you about the is something that, being a New Yorker, the president will understand, not being able to subtract state and local taxes, not to be able to deduct those from your taxes. I would think that that's something that he really understands and understands how important it is to states like Maryland and New Jersey and New York and other high tax states.
Certainly, and I think this is one of the, you know, kind of common themes that people want to attack. But if you look at it, only 30% of people actually itemize. You take that and you combine that with the larger standard deduction and the larger child tax credit, that's going to outweigh a lot of the loss that you might have from the state and local tax deductions.
So what is the president's feeling on that? Is the president behind keeping that?
Getting rid of that deduction?
Getting rid of that deduction, or is he wants to keep the deduction?
The president's laid out his framework, and he's still consistent and on board with where we are right now. He knows that there is somewhat of a negotiation that may have to take place. We're certainly not going to do that in the press, but right now we're very committed to where we are in the framework, and that hasn't changed since we've started. Uh-huh.
I want to ask you about sort of next steps on the health care bill. He talked about it yesterday and the fact that they need to keep these subsidy payments going in the form of Congress paying for them if they're going to do it. How long can we expect those subsidy payments? What does the president want? What does he want out of Congress here for health care?
Well, I mean, I think he has said pretty clearly, ideally, he'd love to repeal and replace Obamacare completely. Until then, he is taking steps to help improve the system, whether it's through executive order that allows more flexibility, or whether it's in some cases the CSR payments were frankly not necessarily a lawful process, and making sure that we aren't overstepping, but we actually have a lawful process moving forward.
Is he's supportive of the Alexander Murray bill in order to keep to shore up these health insurance markets?
I don't think we've seen a finalized package of that yet, and we're not going to weigh in on draft legislation until we have a little bit better understanding of what that final product may look like.
Okay.
But we're certainly on board with actions that will provide greater flexibility, certainly give more flexibility to the states. That's something the president's been a big advocate of, and ultimately lower cost and provide more insurance, something that you don't see through Obamacare. I think a competition is a big piece that we would like to see in any healthcare plan moving forward. That's one of the big pieces that's been missing, I think, out of the last couple of years.
Last question for you, and this is not a commentary on your ability to do a press briefing, but can we see the president do more press briefings?
We'll certainly put that in. I'm always happy to let him take the questions for the day, and I think it's both beneficial to him and to the American people to get to hear directly from the president, and I know that there's no one that's a better messenger for his agenda and for his policy initiatives than him, and so he takes questions pretty regularly, whether it's on the way to Marine One or in the Rose Garden. I think you may see some more of that from time to time.
All right, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, very grateful to have you join us on Mornings on the Mall.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
My name is Vince Colonnais alongside Mary Walter.
Good morning, Vince. So at the Values Voters Summit, we had Steve Bannon saying some very interesting things, and to get his take on that, Newt Gingrich is joining us. Newt, welcome back to Mornings on the Mall. It's so great to have you here.
I'm always glad to be with you and have a chance to talk about what's going on.
Yeah, so we were just going to talk about the about Steve Bannon at the Values Voters Summit on Saturday. He said this.
This is not my war. This is our war. And y'all didn't start it. The establishment started it.
Speaker Gingrich, should we be at war with the Republican establishment?
Well, I think it's a pretty strange strategy. I mean, in World War II, we didn't decide the first thing we ought to do is go beat Great Britain. Look, there are 10 Democrats in the U.S. Senate up next year from states that President Trump carried. Six of them are from states he carried by a huge margin. I'd really love to see Steve take most of that money and put it right into races to beat Democrats, because those are the people, when we talk about who voted no, remember there were 16 Democrats who voted no for every Republican, and yet for some reason people want to focus on the no's, and in Bannon's case he even wants to focus on people who voted yes on Obama, on repealing Obamacare. So I don't understand his strategy. I mean, I understand the PR side of it makes lots of noise, people get excited. But the fact is, the job of Republicans ought to be to beat Democrats, increase the Republican majority. If McConnell had a 56 or 58 seat Republican majority, he'd pass everything. So I just, you know, I come out of a different background. When Reagan had a principle of his 11th commandment was don't speak ill of other Republicans. And I grew up in the Reagan era believing that our job was to focus on beating liberal Democrats, not to beat Republicans.
But there's a lot of voters out there, excuse me, Republican voters, who are upset with the state of their Republican
Sure.
Party, particularly in the Senate, where they feel like nothing gets accomplished. Two of the things that Steve Bannon reportedly wants out of the candidates he's seeking are for them to call for Mitch McConnell to be fired, and then also to end the current filibuster, which basically doesn't allow for anything to be debated.
Sure, look, I understand what he wants, but I just want to point out that the effort that was made in 10 and 12 to pick very hard right candidates in the Senate races cost us at least four seats and put us in a position where we have a smaller majority than we would have had had we nominated people who would win general elections. So taking all this money, putting it into the primaries, I don't see how that expands the Republican base. And, you know, I don't care whether it's Mitch McConnell or it's anybody else. If you only have 52 members in the Senate, that means any three can defeat you. If you have 56 or 58 members, you are likely to pass almost everything you want on reconciliation.
So you don't think that it's a problem of leadership, as some people have been saying, that, you know, this is a problem of leadership and Mitch McConnell needs to go? You don't feel that way?
Look, I think this is a problem of numbers.
Okay.
You have a chance next year, a unique chance, because of who's up for election, to defeat at least six and maybe as many as 10 Democrats and create a Republican majority that will last for a generation in the Senate. Or you have a chance to throw it away, get involved in six or eight bitter, divisive Republican primaries, waste millions and millions of dollars, and end up, you know, what if you end up at 48? You think the minority leader, who, if it's not McConnell, at 48 is going to do better? And I just think this is a very dangerous game. I understand what Bannon and his financial supporters are doing. And they, as Americans, have every right to do what they want to, but I don't have to pretend it makes any sense.
But, you know, Speaker Gingrich, you know, the construction of the Senate's rules right now, where they have this technical filibuster that they can use to stop anything from getting to the floor, the minority can, without it having 60 votes of support, it really frustrates the House in a big way, especially as they try and get legislation passed. They kind of describe it as trying to cram these things through a very narrow keyhole for the Senate's rules. Shouldn't it be that we only allow the speaking filibuster to be the only true filibuster in the Senate?
Sure. I think that's the middle ground between ending the filibuster and keeping it, is to require it to be a genuine filibuster, which it used to be. There was a time when you had to actually speak, and I think that would be a very reasonable step. But I would also point out, you know, McConnell has gotten much tougher, for example, on the blue slip process of stopping judges. He has gotten tougher. He got conservative Supreme Court justice through by insisting that they change the rules to a simple majority. You know, so there's been some change, But I just want to go back to, you know, everybody wants to focus on some sleight of hand. If we were to focus on defeating the Democrats who voted no, every single one of them voted no on repealing Obamacare. So there were 16 Democratic no's for every Republican. It's a little strange to me to focus on the three. And by the way, most of the people Bannon wants to defeat are not in the three. Most of the people that Bannon wants to defeat voted yes for repealing Obamacare. So this is not like he's going to go after people who are uniquely bad by his standard based on what he wants to do. So, you know, again, he has every right to do it. I just think as a strategist, you know, that is exactly wrong. It's the opposite of what Reagan would have done. And it doesn't build a bigger Republican majority. And if you get a big enough Republican majority, everybody's going to be happy because it gets easy to get things done.
Mr. Speaker, in the time we have left here, tell us about your new book, Vengeance.
Well, Vengeance, I think, is a very important book because it illustrates how terrorists could get two super tankers of oil, swap it to the North Koreans for nuclear material, not necessarily a bomb, but nuclear material, and how the world is connected. And it makes two key points. One, your opponents can do lots of things you don't necessarily plan for. So just having anti-ballistic missile defenses may not be enough if North Korea has nuclear material. And two, you have to think in terms of networks of allies against you. It's not just the North Koreans versus the U.S. or the Iranians versus the U.S., but what are the network of allies designed to try to defeat America? And I think Vengeance does a very good job of bringing to life in a novel a very exciting, very dynamic story, but one which has a very big national security component.
You can find Newt Gingrich's gripping new novel, Vengeance, in bookstores and on Amazon everywhere. Thank you very much, Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, for joining us this morning.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us right now is Lisa DePasquale. She's the author of a new book called The Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z. Lisa, good morning. Welcome to Mornings on the Mall.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I love this book. I've seen this book out. I know people who have this book. It's fantastic, and it's not what you think. It's really not a handbook for social justice warriors, is it?
No. I mean, it's a fun, you know, political humor book that's not mean-spirited, but definitely shows, you know, some of the ridiculous things that these social justice warriors, you know, spend their time thinking about.
The amazing thing to me, Lisa, whenever I think of social justice warriors, it's the idea that words can physically hurt you. That's the thing that always gets me the most.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you probably write a lot about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's one part. The thing is that, you know, initially I was trying to come up with things that, you know, I think might be offensive to them, like trying to create something new. But instead, when I searched, the things that they actually drove them crazy were so funny that I just had to include them. And one of them is a word that I just mentioned, and that's offensive songs. And one of them is Crazy for You by Madonna, because it uses a slur for mental illness.
Oh, I have to tell you, my husband and I, one of our favorite things to do every holiday season is to listen to those songs that are played on the radio in celebration of the holiday season. Mm-hmm. And we can pick out every offensive thing in those songs. It's a thing that we do. So that could be a whole chapter in your book, and I can help you with that. You talk about a social justice warrior bug out bag. Why would I need a bag? In what instance? And what should I have in it?
Oh, well, this might be like if you go to Coachella or Fyre Festival, or maybe just, you know, end up camping out for concert tickets or something like that, or maybe you get thrown out of your parents' home. So in your bug-out bag, you want to have, you know, some sort of non-GMO vegan snack that will last you a day or two. you know, some LaCroix or, you know, some kind of sparkling water. And then also just because being on your own can be hard, maybe something for inspiration to read, like Lena Dunham's book. So you want to take care of all your needs, but don't worry about having, you know, pen and paper or a flashlight or anything like that because you have your phone.
I wonder, Lisa, you know, there's so many issues that we deal with on a daily basis that feel like they fall squarely in the wheelhouse of sort of the social justice warrior. And I look at things like, you know, people accusing each other of cultural appropriation for, say, liking rap music or wearing their hair the wrong way. So what else does the book get into? What other things can we find inside here?
Well, you can find how to ruin a holiday meal with your food philosophy. So, you know, how to, you know,
oh, I love that.
Be arrive as a guest at someone's house and complain about whether they got their, you know, whether the green bean casserole has dairy and if the turkey is free range. And
yes, my favorite is people who demand turkey. My favorite is people who demand gluten free and don't have any need for it. That's my favorite category of person.
Yeah, and that's the thing is food philosophy is sort of like your gender. It can be totally fluid. So you want to make sure you change it to be what's most inconvenient for your host.
The other thing that I notice a lot with social justice warriors is the extent to which they use social media to convey their feelings. That's about the extent of their activism in some cases, where they'll just sort of like get on their Facebook page, click like on a cause, and that's about the end of it. They're not going to be more involved than that. Have you noticed that that's sort of the social justice warrior base?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some virtue signaling when it comes to being a slacktivist. The other thing that they like to do is, get companies to, you know, pull ads or boycott companies. And the problem is that the media is, or well, to them, it's a positive. The media is their cohorts in this. So, you know, they can tweet to the New York Times and say, you know, we're seeing these ads on this website and we disagree and this, you know, store should stop advertising here. And the New York Times will write it up and not even mention that the accounts that are, you know, tweeting to them have like 2 or 10 followers. You know, this isn't representing some groundswell of outrage.
Lisa DePasquale, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you on Mornings on the Mall.
Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa DePasquale, author of the new book, Social Justice Warrior Handbook, a practical survival guide for snowflakes, millennials, and Generation Z.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.